There's got to be an explanation to all these UFO sightings, right? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Are you having flashbacks from this music? It's not just to tell you there's a new episode of 22 Hours. There's been a fairly big update in the case, and it actually has to do with this very song. First, let's acknowledge it's been a while. We wrapped up our last episode at the end of August 2019. In the nearly year and a half since then, a lot has happened. The coronavirus, the George Floyd protests over racial justice over the summer, the election, the storming of the Capitol last week. But even though it's been some time since our last episode, we want to come to you because we have an update in this case. Darren Wint's new attorneys in the D.C. Public Defender Service have filed a legal brief in his case asking an appeals court judge to throw out Darren's conviction and requesting a new trial. This happened just a few days before Christmas 2020. There's a lot that's still up in the air, though. We don't have the prosecutor's response to this filing, but it could be a while before we get that. It took the defense nearly 2 years from Darren's sentencing to file this appeal paperwork. But this is just the way the justice system works. In small, sometimes barely perceptible steps, long after the media glare has faded, piece by piece, document by document, the system moves forward. And though it's only one step in what will likely be years more before Darren Wynn's case is closed, it's the first movement since his sentencing. And we know there's been a great deal of interest in this case. So what's the basis for the appeal? Why should Darren Wint, who prosecutors said committed one of the most heinous crimes in the history of D.C., get a new trial? It goes back to this song, Haters Hate, which you know goes to the heart of Darrell Wint's whereabouts on May 13th and 14th of 2015. We learned more about Darrell toward the end of the trial. It was the week after Darren took the stand and accused his brothers of killing Sava, Amy, and Philip Savopoulos and Vera Figueroa inside the family's home on Woodland Drive. When he testified, you'll remember that Darren laid out this long, complicated story of how he thought he was going to the Savopoulos house to finish a painting and drywall job with Darrell. He said he thought his two younger brothers, Darrell and Stefan, borrowed his van the day before for the job, and he told prosecutors without a way to get home, he stayed the night at Ed's house. It was after Darren took the stand that prosecutors, in what's known as the rebuttal phase, called Darrell to testify. That was a surprise. We'd gone through the whole trial wondering where Darrell was and if we would hear from him. Okay, just to briefly recap, here's what Darrell said when he took the stand. He said on May 13th, the day the Savopoulos family and Vera Figueroa were taken captive, that he'd gone to PCM services to fill out an application for a job to paint a dorm at George Washington University in D.C. Then he'd gone to his friend Anthony Anderson's house in Gaithersburg, Maryland, to watch the music video Anthony helped shoot for a song called Haters Hate that he was planning to drop that very day.
Watch them haters hate, they get mad, I'm so glad today. Every time I hit the streets, I bet the freaks cooperate. Yes, yes, you know they call me Mr. Mode, I do not contemplate. I see, I want, I cry, I get that just the way I operate.
Both Darrell and Anthony testified they couldn't remember the actual day Darrell came over to watch that music video, but they did remember it was the day Anthony released the Haters Hate video on YouTube. And sure enough, prosecutors pulled up a screenshot from YouTube showing Haters Hate was uploaded on May 13th, 2015. On the day the Savopoulos family and Vera Figueroa were taken captive on Woodland Drive, this evidence presented by the prosecutors showed that Darrell Wint was 20 miles away in suburban Maryland. So here's where Darren's appeal comes in. There was another witness who was at Anthony Anderson's house the day they gathered to watch the new video on YouTube. Anthony's cousin, a woman named Ikea Williams, was also there. In the spring of 2015, she was living with Anthony at the house in Gaithersburg. In fact, it was her house, and Anthony sort of came and went, she said. She was friendly with Darrell, too. Now, Ikea Williams didn't testify during Darren's trial. This is why it's the first time you're hearing of her. But she did testify before the grand jury back in 2015, which then indicted Darren on the murder charges. That's where this information comes from, that she was in the house, her grand jury testimony. She says she remembers Darrell coming over sometime in May 2015 and watching Anthony's new music video. She didn't remember the exact day either, but she says Darrell usually called or texted to say he was outside the door, and she said that she was pretty sure that's what he had done that day. That's when Darren's lawyers pounced. Because her phone records showed the only call or text between the two of them in May 2015 was a text message on May 19th. The defense said, sure, maybe Darrell stopped by Anthony's house to watch Haters Hate, but it was nearly a week after the murders, not an alibi for the day the victims were taken hostage. The problem for the defense was prosecutors never called Ikea Williams to testify during the trial. She was on the list of witnesses that prosecutors said they'd planned to call, and the defense was apparently banking on that. They'd already rested their case at this point. But at the last minute, prosecutors decided not to call Ikea Williams as a witness. As Anthony Anderson was testifying, Assistant U.S. Attorney Chris Bruckman passed a note to Laura Bach. They agreed Anthony Anderson's memory of that day was strong enough that they didn't need to call Ikea Williams. He held up, Laura Bach, the prosecutor, told the judge to explain why they hadn't called Ikea Williams. She said, everything we needed came in. This whole thing about prosecutors not calling Ikea Williams, it actually came up during the trial. We could tell the lawyers were arguing about something that seemed significant, but sitting in the courtroom gallery that day, we couldn't get the full picture. The lawyers went up to the bench to make their case to the judge after the jury had filed out of the courtroom. And at times we heard them raise their voices, but it was far enough away that we couldn't really make out what was at issue. We knew the passion wasn't for the jury's benefit. They weren't there. But it was clear Judy Pipe and Laura Bach were adamant in their body language and their raised voices, apparently citing all these legal precedents to make their case. Also, this was all going on during what was technically a break in the courtroom. So not only was the jury out, but there were also people coming in and out of the courtroom. And oddly enough, there was some kind of construction going on in a neighboring courtroom, and this hammering noise was bleeding over into our courtroom. So, yeah, a dramatic courtroom scene from A Few Good Men or fill in the blank, this was not that. Anyway, we could tell based on what led up to the break that the attorneys were arguing over calling an additional witness named Ikea Williams, who might complicate Darrell's alibi. The judge denied it pretty quickly, and then the court moved on to closing arguments. That's why it's really only now that we have transcripts on this exchange that we can put it into context. The defense wanted to question Ikea Williams because they thought her account of that day could weaken Darrell's alibi that put him in Gaithersburg at a friend's house the morning of May 13th, when prosecutors say Amy, Philip, and Vera were being taken hostage. Her testimony could rebut Darrell's account of where he said he was, and it could also contradict Anthony Anderson's testimony recalling that Darrell was at his house that day. Darren's lead defense attorney, Judy Pipe, said since the prosecution hadn't called Ikea Williams as they had indicated they would, she hadn't gotten a chance to cross-examine her, and she wanted that chance. Judy Pipe asked the judge for one more phase of the trial known as sur rebuttal so that the defense could call Ikea Williams for themselves. Prosecutor Laura Bach was aghast. She said if Ikea Williams was so critical to the defense, they should have called her when they were presenting their case, not dependent on the prosecution to do so. Basically, she was saying they lost their chance. And Laura Bach said, providing an alibi for Darrell was not part of the prosecution's case, that accounting for Darrell's whereabouts on May 13th only became relevant after Darren took the stand and accused his brothers of the killings. But Judy Pipe was unrelenting, and we saw this on her face that day. The transcript shows she responded that the defense had a right to call Ikea Williams, a witness that they said would contradict Anthony Anderson's testimony. Quote, I dare to say this is probably the most critical issue in the trial. if the jury believes that Darrell Wint was at the home of Ikea Williams and Anthony Anderson in those morning hours instead of where Darren Wint says he was, we lose. Her argument did not sway the judge. Judge Juliet McKenna said Ikea Williams' statements would not have directly contradicted Anthony Anderson's. She said they were, quote, equivocal. She was making the point that Ikea Williams' recollection of what Darrell would have done, I believe he called me or he usually does, was not so definitive. And the judge also said this was not a new matter, legally speaking. She said, and again, this is straight from the transcript, quote, if I'm to interpret, as defense counsel's asking me to, that this somehow is new evidence or new matters, trials would never end. We would just continue to go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth because the whole reason we have this trial is that the government's evidence is different from the defense's evidence. So that would be a never-ending cycle of witnesses coming through. She said Darrell's whereabouts were not a new issue. Quote, the defense squarely puts Darrell Wint's whereabouts on May 13th and 14th at issue in its defense case. When prosecutors called Darrell to the stand in their rebuttal case, they were attempting to rebut what was introduced in the defense case. The judge said other cases where defendants successfully won the right to an extra phase of the trial, a surrebuttal phase, was when there was an element of surprise, where a witness testified in a way that the defense never would have expected or could have accounted for. But in this case, the judge said, it was the defense who made Darrell's whereabouts a key part of the case, since they were accusing him of being the real culprit. This is the heart of the defense's appeal, that the judge's decision on this was wrong, as a matter of law. In the legal brief that Darren's lawyers filed, they said Ikea Williams' testimony would have, quote, seriously undermined part of Darrell's alibi, and, quote, strongly cast doubt on his version of events. Doubt that, in the jury's mind, could have affected the verdict. It says by not allowing Judy Pipe to present the surrebuttal case, quote, it robbed the defense of presenting a powerful piece of evidence that Darrell did indeed have the opportunity to commit the offenses and that he was lying about his whereabouts on May 13th. I know the game fucked up, but it's an eye for an eye. I know the game fucked up, but it's an eye for an eye.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hi, Jack Moore. We're back again.
Indeed.
Although we weren't entirely surprised, we have to say, because we knew that Darren Wint's attorneys would be appealing. I mean, Judy Pipe told us that they were going to be appealing, but we just didn't know when.
Right. And they had filed the paperwork. Basically, they file a notice of appeal that says, you know, we will be appealing this. And then it takes months. They compile the transcripts, so they have to order all the transcripts as well, and then they get several deadlines of when they have to file this legal brief, and it had been extended, you know, probably 6 or 7 times.
Okay, so we should say, when we saw Judy Pipe and Laura Bock sort of like squaring off over this issue at the bench, we couldn't hear what they were saying. We were sort of in the back of the courtroom, as you've already heard, and it wasn't the first or the last time that they had taken a dispute up to the bench to be resolved with the judge. And we said in one of our previous episodes, we knew that Darren was appealing. We specifically didn't know what the appeal was going to be.
When they were arguing about this at the bench, I mean, it was, you know, kind of coming toward the end of the trial. And, you know, that was vociferous in the moment. And then it seemed to be over and done with. You know, the judge denied the surrebuttal request and then move on. Except, you know, it's not exactly case closed because here we are talking about it in the appeal.
Yeah, I just think it's sort of like, as a listener to this podcast, you're like, who the heck is this person? I've listened to this whole podcast and I've never heard her name. Well, she never testified. And we didn't know, I mean, honestly, that this was going to be at issue. So it's sort of interesting that we're introducing a new character with this appeal. But yeah, sometimes that's the way it goes. OK, so let's go into the legal basis for this appeal and kind of break this down.
So
So the judge's reasoning for why she said the defense shouldn't get this extra phase of the trial was for two reasons. And the one is like much easier to understand. Does IKEA Williams' testimony rebut what the prosecution said in the rebuttal phase? Mm-hmm. So is it actually rebuttal evidence? And then also, is this actually a new matter? So maybe if we start with the rebuttal part, because what the defense says is that, yes, this does rebut, because the judge actually interpreted IKEA Williams' grand jury testimony, kind of misinterpreted it, because the judge said that IKEA Williams' testimony was equivocal, that sometimes, you know, Durrell texted or called, usually he did. But if you actually read word for word in the grand jury testimony, IKEA Williams said on that day that he came over and we watched Haters Hate, Durrell texted or called.
Okay, so I'm looking at the transcript now, page 11 of IKEA Williams' grand jury testimony. So I'm just going to read it so you guys can hear word for word. So this is Laura Bach asking her the question, and she says, all right, did he either text you or call you prior to coming to your house? IKEA Williams says, he texted me. Durrell did? Yes. And when he was outside of your house, did he text you or call you, as best as you can recall? I believe he called me and told me he was at the door. And he wouldn't have called you on, they give the number, but we'll leave it out here. IKEA Williams responds, yes. And why do you think he called you to let you know he was at the door? It could have been because I was upstairs, but, I mean, Anthony was downstairs, but he usually does that. Like, if he's at the door, he'll tell me. He won't knock. He'll just tell me he's at the door, and I'll just open it. He'll just say, I'm outside? Mm-hmm. Is that a yes? Yes, I'm sorry. And that's it. But it's funny because initially she says, he texted me. And then 10 seconds later, she says, I believe he called me and told me he was at the door. So there is a little bit of question there.
So it's, so they're saying, you know, this, so that, you know, reading the actual words of the transcript, this is rebuttal evidence.
By the way, for those who aren't as familiar with the word equivocal, it sort of means like open to interpretation, ambiguous, questionable.
But the thing is, in the brief that the defense attorneys filed, they said even if her statements are open to more than one interpretation, that it should have been for the jury to decide what the true interpretation is, not the judge.
You know what I sort of thought was interesting, and tell me if this is the right time to raise this, but during Anthony Anderson's testimony, when Chris Bruckman hands Laura Bach the note that says, basically, we don't need to call IKEA Williams because we got it, doesn't that indicate to you that there was a possibility that they weren't going to get what they need from Anthony Anderson? He wasn't going to be, you know, give them the detail that they needed to prove to the jury that Durrell was there. So I guess my point is, you don't know what would have happened if IKEA Williams was called to the stand, because they didn't know what was going to happen when Anthony Anderson was called to the stand. There were obviously questions in their mind if he was going to give them enough. Then they end up passing this note in the middle of his testimony saying, we got it, we don't need to call her. But she could have gotten up and said and been more definitive or been less. We don't know. Well, I mean, it wasn't a slam dunk.
I am 95% certain that somewhere here in these transcripts, it says that Anthony Anderson did not go before the grand jury. So in a sense, the prosecution wasn't quite sure what they were going to get out of him in terms of how clear his memory was going to be. And the thing is that the whole reason why IKEA Williams was on the prosecution witness list is because they saw her as cumulative to Durrell's alibi, meaning that the whole point about on the morning of May 13th, where he was, he said he was in Gaithersburg. He was at Anthony Anderson's house watching Haters Hate. Mm-hmm. IKEA Williams is all cumulative to that. The only question is, well, what day was it for certain? And she doesn't remember, but she says usually he called or texted, and she was pretty sure he did on this day. So they were to the prosecution point of view, that's 90% in alignment with what Anthony Anderson said, with what Durrell said. The 10% is exactly what day it was.
Right. Which was the part that Anthony Anderson and Durrell were a little fuzzy on in their testimony, because they said it was the Haters Hate day, that the day the video dropped, but they couldn't remember the day, like the date or the time or anything like that.
Right. And then and I don't know if this is the time to bring up the second tier of the appeal, which is the judge said this wasn't a new matter. and, you know, what that means legally.
And essentially, right. Yeah, we're not attorneys, but we've read this thing, you know, and as you guys know, we know the details of this case, although we did have to reacquaint ourselves because it's been a minute since we did our podcast. But the new matter thing is essentially the judge was saying, we've already been over this. The defense brought up Darrell's whereabouts to start with. That's you guys are the ones who introduced him as being, you know, the potential culprit in this.
So this is one where I can really see both. I can see both sides because what the prosecution said and what the judge agreed to when she denied the defense their sir rebuttal was Darrell's alibi writ large was at issue. His whereabouts were at issue throughout the whole trial because on day one, the defense said Darrell did this. So broadly speaking, they made his whereabouts relevant. Mm-hmm. And then in the rebuttal case, the prosecution came in and provided an alibi for him.
So you'd think if you were the defense, you'd immediately want to pull and call as many people as you could to substantiate any evidence you had that he wasn't in Gaithersburg when he said he was watching that video.
Right. But the thing is, this actual specifics of where Darrell was not raised until rebuttal. I mean, that's just a statement of fact. You know, Darrell did not testify in the case in chief of the prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
So this one is one that I think the lawyers will have to decide because I could, you know, from a layperson's perspective, I could see both sides.
It was interesting, too. So in the appeal, it says the matter was first raised by the government in its rebuttal case. The case law allowed him to present his contrary evidence as a matter of right. Even if this court disagrees and finds that Williams' testimony did not go to such a new matter, the trial court should have allowed or denied sir rebuttal subject to the court's sound exercise of discretion, as opposed to what the judge did here, erect a blanket rule that sir rebuttal was impermissible as a matter of law. And that's, you know, that is kind of legalese, but basically they're saying discretion was needed and discretion wasn't given.
Right. So that's kind of like their other thing in their back pocket. So if the appeals court judge says this isn't necessarily a new matter, they can say, you know, even if it's not technically new, the judge was supposed to consider everything and then make a decision. And instead, in the language of her ruling issued from the bench, it was pretty cut and dry, you know, saying, you know, as a matter of law, she didn't think the defense was entitled. And they said this, and this is again to the legalese, but in the appeal, it says a failure to exercise discretion in a matter requiring discretion is itself an abuse of discretion.
Sorry.
But that, you know, so yeah, but I think that, you know, gets to, there's a number of prongs that the defense is clearly raising here.
Right. And the last one being that it wasn't going to take that much time. I mean, they were saying, you know, the judge has the quote where she says, you know, we could be here, you know, just go back and forth and back and forth, essentially saying, you know, you can't just let testimony go on and on and on. At some point, this has to end. Their response to that is, yeah, but we only wanted to call one person. It wasn't going to go on and on and on. So they kind of challenged that part of her ruling as well.
Yes. And they cite this fascinating case that I was trying to do a little bit of extra research on out of Mississippi. And it's a 1981 Mississippi Supreme Court case. It was a manslaughter case. The guy was convicted and it was undisputed that this guy named Larry Edge had killed another man.
Mm-hmm.
But Edge said that he did so because the other guy had a knife to Edge's wife's throat and she was literally in his clutches. And so he shot the guy. And as a result, his wife's coat was covered in blood. And she testified that her coat was covered in blood. And that was evidence to the defense that this guy was literally on top of her and, you know, threatening her harm.
Right.
In rebuttal, the prosecution presented evidence from a sheriff and two other people who said after the shooting, they didn't see any blood on this woman's coat. So the defense then wanted to have a brief sir rebuttal case where they called one additional witness who saw the wife right after the shooting and said she did have blood on her coat.
Mm-hmm. So same thing. It's just one additional witness.
Right. And the judge rejected. And the phrasing that this judge used is very similar to the judge in the Wendt case. The judge in this Mississippi case said, if they had this additional phase of the trial, it would be, quote, continual testimony and we would never get out of here. Now, this case was appealed to the Mississippi Supreme Court in 1981, and they said fundamental fairness and due process required that Larry Edge be allowed to call the one additional witness. So I think it's very interesting that even the language is very similar. Now, I can't find what ended up happening in his new trial.
How it actually ended up.
Yeah.
I think in the end, just pulling back a little bit, what is this appeal really saying, right? I mean, is this the smoking gun? No. Jack, can you explain, this is less really about what IKEA Williams had to say and more about the larger idea of the process and whether Darren got a fair trial?
Right. Yeah. Like, I think, I mean, the substance of what she's saying matters to some extent because the defense says it would have created doubt about Durrell's alibi. But at the end of the day, the appeals court is not going to hear this appeal and then, you know, declare Darren is innocent and Durrell is guilty. That what they're looking at is the process, and the process kept IKEA Williams from testifying. And was that enough to have changed the outcome? If the jury had heard IKEA Williams testifying and believed that it may have contradicted what Durrell was saying and that was swirling around their head when they deliberating, would the jury have come to a different conclusion?
Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see how long this takes, to be honest with you guys. I mean, we could be coming to you in a couple months. We could be coming back to you and updating you in a year, because given how long it took for them to file this appeal, the government technically has until, I think it's the end of February, to respond. But the chances of them getting an extension on that, given the fact that the defense had a huge extension, is pretty good.
And, you know, because it's been a while, some things have changed. You know, some of the people that you've heard of throughout this podcast have new jobs, new roles. So we thought this would be a good time to, you know, kind of update.
So where are they now?
Well, one thing, you know, just to start off with, so Darren Wint has all new attorneys. They're still through the D.C. Public Defender Service, but they have attorneys that work specifically on appeals. So he has three attorneys that are arguing this case now.
Right. And Judy Pipe is no longer handling Darren's case. In fact, she's no longer working for the Public Defender Service at all. She's now a judge herself. She was nominated and named a magistrate judge in D.C. Superior Court last year. And she's working mainly in criminal and domestic violence court, presiding over temporary civil protection orders, arraignments, hearings. But yeah, Judy Pipe's a judge.
It's kind of interesting, you know, seeing some local news coverage here in D.C. to see, you know, her name as a judge.
Yeah.
And now deciding these matters, you know, when defendants should be held, when they shouldn't, you know, it's kind of an interesting change of roles.
And Jack, Laura Bach, who was the lead prosecutor, is still at the U.S. Attorney's Office for D.C.
Yes. And she actually is now the deputy chief of the office's homicide division, where she oversees the prosecution of murders in the city. It's a very, you know, kind of important role and high profile, you know, depending on, the cases that come before her desk.
Yeah, we have a case we're following in D.C. now of a 10-year-old little girl who was shot and killed. And I've been covering that case. And there are 11 people being tried, but 10 of them in connection with the killing. And she's actually overseeing two groups of people going to two separate trials because there's so many defendants. So it's an interesting case.
And of course, the court system, like court systems all throughout the country, has been totally rocked by the coronavirus pandemic. Jury trials in D.C. are on hold. Things are still proceeding, you know, with other kind of matters and legal arguments, and things are being filed and they're having remote hearings. But things are really kind of tied up. And in fact, I don't know if people remember, we had made this big request to get audio recordings of the trial. And, you know, it was something that had never been done. And even the existence of the audio recordings was not widely known of trials in D.C. Superior Court. And we got the chief judge to agree to look at the matter and to, you know, study it and begin to move in that direction possibly. And we've been hearing that, you know, they are looking into it. They've, you know, convened panels and, you know, fingers crossed, it looks like it might be heading that way. But, you know, the justice system has its own tempo. And then, of course, with the coronavirus pandemic, it's just kind of slowed everything down. The last update is they're still looking at it.
And we got the most, I guess, hopeful update right before the pandemic hit. And then it was like, you know, kind of back burner. So we're hoping to hear more soon. So that's our update, guys. We will, of course, bring you more when we have it, and hopefully it comes soon. But everyone stay safe, stay well, and thanks again for listening. 22 Hours, An American Nightmare was written, edited, and produced by Jack Moore and me, Megan Cloherty. Julia Ziegler is our content advisor.